I'm Professor Trevor Plonich. I'm the chair of the Department of English, and I just want to say a couple of very brief words to welcome you all here today for our departmental discussion of the white paper on the future of graduate education and training. I am very grateful to everybody involved in organizing this, not least of all Professor Paul Jackson and Professor Peter Gibeon, who have taken tremendous initiative to have what I take to be a crucial, indeed pivotal discussion at the departmental level about some obvious concerns for all of us, especially, of course, for the graduate students. Peter will do a little introduction of the panelists and then lay out how it is that we're going to proceed. I look forward to having a very spirited, enlightened, and enlightening discussion as we proceed. So, Peter, please.
Thanks, sir. So, thank you all for coming on Friday afternoon before snowfall. And welcome to our town hall discussion on the future of graduate education and training in the humanities, organized by the Department of English and the graduate program of the Department of English. The plan is to give the discussion a focus, but really a point of departure, by having us all read in advance, we think, the iPlace white paper on the future of the PhD in the humanities. GAC members have been for a long time talking about how we wanted to set up a session for what we were calling our big picture session, where we would just discuss the grad program curriculum, grad program requirements, grad program goals, etc., and not just deal with day-to-day crises and things like that. So when the white paper from iPlay came along, we thought this would be give us the perfect opportunity to serve as sort of, again, the focus for some sort of such a discussion. And we're hoping it will be a conversation starter. It is, very valuable as a call to thought, as a thought experiment, a provocation to new thinking about graduate education. But comments and responses today need not focus solely on the white paper. And we hope, in fact, that many of the panelists and participants in the open discussion will have other things to say on many other things. Picking up from that series of discussions organized, I guess, mainly by Maggie Kilgore last year on the future of the humanities, this town hall on the white paper will begin with a panel of speakers, professors in the English department, grad students in the English department, one postdoctoral fellow in the English department, who will each attempt briefly to present their own remarks on this issue. So I thought the first panelist, or to introduce the panel, would be Paul Yackney, who is a professor in the English department as well as founder and I think still head of iPlay, among other things, who can introduce the whole history and future of this iPlay white paper project.
Thank you very much, Peter. Thank you, Trevor, for this. I wanted to say I'm proud of this department for being the first department at McGill to take this on in such a substantial way. I think that we're going to bring other groups of people into the discussion. That's all that has started, and move forward both as individually and in collective like departments, but also across the campus. Let me tell you where the white paper comes from. My colleague Lee Yetter, who's no longer my colleague, she now works for the province. She was executive director of iPlay, and she brought a SHRC program to my attention about 18 months ago, and it was something like knowledge synthesis grant. Higher education skills training in the Canadian labor market. I said, come on, this is not what we do here. And she persisted, and she wrote the grant application and got the grant. And we formed a group of people, mostly from McGill, elsewhere in Canada, and a couple of colleagues from the States, to think about the PhD. And we did a great deal of study of all of the statistical and analytical work that has been done over the past 20 years around the PhD, a lot of it from our colleagues in the United States. And as you know from reading the white paper, we laid out as far as we could tell, what the situation is for placement rates within the academy for PhDs in the humanities. As far as we can tell, of all of the people who enter PhD programs in the humanities in Canada, 50% of them do not complete on average. And of the 50% that do complete, what did we say? About 20 to 25% get academic jobs of some kind. So we didn't know how many of those were tenure track and how many of those were not. One of the recommendations, as you know from reading the paper, is that universities need to track, do a much better job of tracking than we have done. So we started with that very dire statistic, which has not been something that's unknown to people in the academy for the past 50 years. It hasn't changed that much in the past half century. We didn't recommend cutting programs, we recommended changing them. And we argued that humanities at the top of its form was valuable for the universities itself. They made universities what universities are. That is, not only places that are kind of large containers of knowledge, but places that teach people how to think and to press against the boundaries of methodologies and theories. And you need PhD students in the humanities to push against the existing and received wisdom within their individual disciplines. It's also, we argued in the white paper, extremely valuable for Canadian society to have humanities at the top of its form. And here we did something that the Americans have never done. We said it's not only about the economy, it's also about the polity. It's about the university's responsibility to the well-being of Canada as a political community. And then we laid out some possible ways of reforming the humanities. We provided a couple of imaginative model programs, and then we have a set of recommendations. I've never done policy work in my life before, except a short thing I did with colleagues on in defense of the humanities, and I have been extremely encouraged by the reception it's had, both in Canada and elsewhere. But in Canada, it's been simply remarkable. And as a consequence of both the uptake and my growing sense of the value of the work and how urgent it is to do it, I started over the summer talking to colleagues across the country. And I sent it to every dean of arts and every graduate dean in the country. We got it translated into French as well. And I'd send it out on a Saturday, and 15 minutes later I'd get a response from a dean who'd say, yes, I read this already. Somebody sent it to me, and yes, we want to be part of it. So we have about 25 universities across the country who've committed to a year-long project, rethinking, where the white paper is a provocation and a starter. The thinking is going forward now about how we can change programs, how we can begin to change the culture, how we can change the way the PhD and the MA also is viewed outside the university in Canadian society, because that's one of the persistent problems that we have. And so the work there is ongoing, and we've asked each institution taking part, now a number of organizations such as SHRC, FQRSC, the Federation for the Humanities and Social Sciences, the Canadian Association of Graduate Studies, they've all come on board with us. And we've asked each participant to give us a 10-page document well in advance of the meeting that will be May 21st and 22nd in Montreal, be here at McGill. Or it's going to have to move off campus because it's getting too big. So we'll have it at a nearby hotel. And we will put these 10-page documents on the website that Casey McCormick has gone live with today or yesterday.
Wednesday.
So we're there. We're running. And we will make sure that we will have abstracts and extracts from these documents so that people can scroll through and see what the thinking is across Canada. At the meeting itself, we begin to rough out the program, but I'll tell you one thing that we'll do for sure. The conference is the 21st and 22nd of May, and there will be a preliminary session on the 20th, and that will be a session for graduate students and postdocs, not a kind of introduction to the subject how to retrain for the job market, but rather to prepare the first plenary of the conference. So the students will do the first plenary session at the conference and set the table for the whole conference. And of course, they will take part in the various work that we do at the conference. And most of that work will be workshops. It will be not very much. There'll be no formal panels as you are used to at academic conferences. Nothing like that. There will be a number of good speakers who have interesting ideas and a lot of work. And we'll have that body of work, which will be about 250 to 300 pages, fortunately with abstracts and extracts, so that people can get a sense of what's already going on. The third part of this is the work that is going on now, the conference in May, and the third part of it is something that we're starting now and will go on past the conference, and that is to bring back to the Academy a substantial number of PhDs who are in non-academic careers. And not to bring them back as full-time something, but to bring them back for, say, a week, a term, to mentor in-program PhD students about what you can do with a PhD, to workshop with faculty like me, so that we can learn that the PhD is not only directed to a career in the Academy, but can lead to lots of other extremely worthwhile, fulfilling, and remunerative careers. I had drinks two nights ago with Kyle Wyatt, who is the managing editor of Walrus Magazine, finished his PhD in English at the University of Toronto 3 years ago. And we had a long talk. I mean, he's still kind of working through this. But finally, he had to admit that he was, in fact, doing valuable work as a public intellectual, producing Walrus Magazine, and that it wasn't a world away from what he'd done as a PhD student, but it was in fact connected to it. So that's the kinds of things that we will be doing going forward from the conference in May. One last thing. We've asked each institution to do a 10-page document, and of course, when we realize that institutions are not, say, three people together over coffee, but how many departments in the Faculty of Arts, and also law. The law faculty is part of this work. Music, religious studies, all of these areas of this university have a stake in this, and we still want only one 10-page document. What that is each university is going to have to decide. However, and Casey and I were just talking about this, the website will have links. So say the English department is going to produce a document, a vision document, a program proposal, and we don't have space for it in this compendium of documents, there will be a link on the site to the English department site so that if people are interested to find out what English departments across the country are thinking, they will be able to do that too. So that's the work that we've done and that is ongoing. I have to say that I was kind of in despair as I actually took on the stats last year. Really, it was very, very hard. And to write the white paper was a really hard task. But the uptake has been really more encouraging than the despair was in the first instance. Thank you.
Thanks, Paul. And I would say that we don't know what we'll do as far as collecting our thoughts, but we are going to be taping this session, so if you know of anyone who wants to hear it later, it will be on the department's website shortly. They can at least hear what people have said today. So I wanted to start, I thought we would start with graduate student voices from our own department. And the first one would be Ariel Buckley, who is a veteran doctoral student with us in 20th century literature, as you would say, and currently one of the co-presidents of EXA, so and jumped at the chance to be a speaker on this panel.
I want to start by saying that while I did disagree with many of the proposals put forth in the white paper, I very much am thankful that it exists. It's the first document that I've read that actually comes from inside the university that in a really explicit and real way addresses the issues facing current and recent doctoral students. particularly the precarious employment conditions and the sense of failure that's experienced by those who either don't or choose not to go on to tenure track work. I do have a lot to say on my own behalf today, but on behalf of EGSA, I've also spoken with a number of recent graduates, so I will say more than I normally would, so bear with me as I go on, because I'd like to touch on some of the comments that I've heard from other people now and hopefully over the course of our conversation. For me, both the authorship of the white paper and the composition of this panel in some ways add to the problem that we're attempting to solve by implying that only those who are currently working and researching within the academy have the authority and expertise to sort of speak about these issues. And it sounds like that's something, Paul, you're saying is already been taken into account for going forward, which is really great and encouraging to hear. Well, I believe deeply in the value of graduate education in the humanities. It does seem to me like this is not mutually exclusive from building professional value beyond the ivory tower, but I do question the extent to which, as sort of academics speaking to academics, we're preaching to the choir in this case. For me, this insularity seems to be reflected at every level of the PhD program as it now stands. There's a sense among both faculty and students, and it's probably in part a survival instinct, that academic research and teaching is a vocation while everything else is just a job. The notion that non-academic professionalization is somehow more superficial or mercenary than the types of personal and professional positioning required in the academic job market feels to me, as a current student and feels to many of my colleagues who are former doctoral students, both toxic and debilitating. I've heard both professors and students make dismissive comments about former doctoral students who have chosen to go on to careers outside of the academy, whether it's stage of teaching, marketing, or something else, with the implication being that they just couldn't hack it, not that they made a different choice or that they opted out. I know the white paper is worrying for many academics, including me in some ways, who feel that the PhD shouldn't stoop to being just job training. But in fact, it already is. It's just training us for a job that no longer exists. So the central question for me, I guess, is not how can we get rid of the dissertation, which for almost everyone I talked to was a profoundly valuable and transformative experience, but how can we start to redefine success for PhD graduates in English? How can we get rid of the culture of shame that we've built up around non-academic work and leave room for students to professionalize themselves in diverse ways, not just one way, without disrupting the kinds of slow, sustained learning that both the white paper and the humanities discussions have talked about as being the sort of central function of what it means to do a dissertation or do graduate studies in the humanities, what seems to me to be the most valuable thing about doing a PhD in the first place. And I think, as the white paper suggests, that we do need to start thinking more flexibly and practically about each element of the program. But I think we need to support and supplement rather than eliminating the masterpiece level work that takes place in the writing of a dissertation. The project proposed as alternatives to the dissertation strike me as being things that many students already undertake on their own, in addition to what's already going on. And my feeling is that we should be doing these things better and more consistently by streamlining and restructuring the non-thesis aspects of the program, rather than trying to replace the thesis aspects. There are sort of five main things that came up in my conversations with other PhDs and former students, areas that I see for improvement. Many of those overlap with what the white paper sort of talked about. And the first is momentum and the structure of the program. One of the biggest issues, I think, with the program as it now stands is that incoming students lose momentum after 2 years of non-dissertation work. I remember how excited I was when I first came into the PhD program to jump right into my own research, and by the time I actually got around to writing my proposal 2 odd years later, I did not feel the same kind of unadulterated fire. I think we might productively spread coursework, professionalization courses, and mentored or collaborated projects aimed at the production of concrete publications over the first few years while still allowing students to propose and begin their actual research. And this has the added benefit of actually forcing us to start thinking about the kind of balancing of teaching and research and publication that we're asked to do if we do go on to academic careers in the future, or really any position where we will be, you know, forced to do time management and balancement in that way. I think it doesn't make a lot of sense to have a full year of coursework that's separate from your research project, that's separate from your dissertation. And that sort of overlaps with the ideas proposed about publication and mentorship. Actually, where I see the alternate programs proposed in the white paper as being most useful is the degree to which they prioritize mentorship and supervision and sort of concrete aims for these things. Like, whereas I see the dissertation as being part of that disinterested, sustained study, I think having concrete publication aims is a really valuable thing. So I think, you know, replacing the CRP with a mentored article or two or an equivalent collaborative project might be useful. As it stands, expectations about the CRP are often vaguely defined and depend on your supervisor, and its value can often be unclear. I had a couple of former colleagues who noted that regardless of whether you go into academic careers or not, publications are sort of tangible, measurable things that are both intellectually and professionally valuable and translate to worlds outside of academia. So I think that's sort of an important element of what I guess the white paper is proposing and what we might try and think about. Opt-in professional training is another thing, rather than having sort of the ProSem, which brings everything at the beginning of the program, why not have sort of professional training that people can seek out or that's distributed throughout the program. Amanda Clark, for instance, mentioned that to bridge a gap between PhD training and workplace training, we need access to certified seminars in education, editing, and digital content management. Our peers outside of academia routinely receive this through their workplaces, and to keep pace, many of us already have to pursue those courses during and after the PhD and pay for them out of pocket. So that's one thing we might think about, and it sounds like, Paul, that's something you've already sort of thought about to a certain extent, but I think making sure that we have a structure in place, that it's not the afterthought, that to a certain extent it has been, where we, you know, sort of have to scramble to find some people who are working in administrative positions on campus to come in and talk to the pro seminar class, who, you know, may or may not be interested at the time. Really thinking about that as being a central aspect of what the non-thesis aspects of the program can do could be really, really helpful for many of us. That overlaps with skills translation, the idea of, you know, fitting positions like research terms that fall under a huge umbrella term that means nothing to anyone. Many of those could easily and productively be renamed to reflect industry standards and the kind of concrete professional translatable skills involved. And finally, the idea of transparency is something that came up again and again. And one place that Peter, you and I have talked about, and a few other people have talked about, is discussing updating McGill's placement pages. And this should be done, I think, with an eye to actually illustrating the types of careers that former PhDs have had, rather than being weighted towards, you know, in favor of the happy few who secure tenure-track jobs, often several years down the road. And ideally, it should provide a well-rounded illustration of what actually happens post-PhD. Maintaining research and placement lists should be a departmental priority, as they offer both prospective and current students and employers a realistic illustration of our current work and our future careers. Letting these lists fall by the wayside as they have seems to me not just unhelpful, but actually to a certain extent unethical in the current economic climate. Also, by giving a voice to and celebrating those working outside of the academy, we have an opportunity to encourage doctoral students to envision alternatives for themselves from the get-go, and also to acknowledge that those who have found rewarding alternative careers are more than just a cautionary tale for lazy students. So, yeah, I'll stop there for now.
A second graduate student voice is a PhD student in the sort of cultural studies, film, TV studies, and things like that, Josie Barr.
All right. Well, I want to start by echoing Ariel's thanks. I do think it's really important that this is something that we talk about within the academy when there is so much focus on the crisis in the humanities outside of the academy. And so I want to start by saying that I think that for a variety of reasons that I don't really feel the need to outline here, the humanities PhD is in obvious need of change in structure significantly. And I'm speaking specifically mostly to one part of the white paper, which says, so I want to strongly agree with the importance of developing the skills required to communicate our work to different audiences, both academic and public. But I do have some questions about the methods proposed here for communicating outside of the academy. And I'm focusing pretty specifically on the example of the workshop PhD proposed in the white paper, because it is, in a way, closest to my own experience, and I imagine might be designed to appeal to someone with that experience. And I assume, do I need to explain what that is? The workshop PhD? No? Okay. I want us to ask how many of these skills a student can reasonably be expected to master in depth in a four-year time span? And I also want to caution us against possibly promoting the use of technology for its own sake. So from my own example, my own experience, I have a BA in individualized studies, which means that in my self-designed undergraduate major, I took classes in cultural studies and cinema studies, but also in film production. I also have 5 years work experience in freelance independent film production before going back to school, and I worked as a videographer for the university where I pursued my MA while I did that. In spite of this experience, I am what could generously be called an incompetent filmmaker. While digital tools have certainly democratized filmmaking in recent years in terms of access, there are still technical skills required that require years of focused study to reach an acceptable level of proficiency, even for a single specialized role, rather than being a single kind of content producer. The example in the white paper spoke specifically about documentary film, and that's why I'm talking about this here, but documentary film production, especially for an audience outside of the classroom, requires significant resources of time, money, equipment, and a crew with a variety of specialized skills. It's really a difficult thing to undertake as a single individual without a great deal of training. And I also want us to ask today how this model would prepare graduates to compete for jobs with people with more specific in-depth skills in these particular areas. I want us to ask, would this person be seen as a competitive candidate for the few available academic jobs against a PhD from a traditional institution? Would someone with a basic technical proficiency that this program seeks to cultivate be competitive for a job requiring technical skills against someone who had honed these skills in a more focused way for years? In my experience, this has not been the case. In a highly competitive job market, candidates with breadth but not necessarily depth may be seen as underqualified. There is a reason I don't work in film production anymore. And none of this is to say that technological and digital literacy cannot be innovative and important methods for disseminating academic research. I strongly believe that students who come into the program with these skills should be encouraged to develop and use them to communicate their research outside the academy, and that students who want to learn these skills should be given the opportunity to do so. I just don't want us to underestimate the value of the skills we're already being taught in the PhD and their possible non-traditional applications, some of which Ariel has been speaking about, some of which Paul has been speaking about already. Since beginning the PhD, I've come to think of myself primarily as a teacher, and I think that we should be able to explore what that means in other contexts than tenure-track jobs, whether that's the stage-up system or high schools, perhaps public or museum education. And the truth is that I really don't know what those options are, but I would like to know. And I also want to remind us that as part of the appeal, I think part of the fundamental appeal of humanities research is that it is in some small way inflated from the demands of the market to allow us to explore and ask in-depth questions without a clearly defined use value. And so I want to caution us against embracing the logic of the market that tells us that we have to do more, better, and faster, especially when it's not entirely clear to me yet, at least, how these skills will translate into lucrative employment, that is, what these jobs might be or who might pay us to perform them, especially. And I regret that what I'm able to provide here is more of a critique than a solution. The PhD clearly needs to be reformed to allow students to explore other job options, but at this point I don't feel like I know what those job options are. And it does sound like the committee is putting together some ways of addressing that, and that sounds like a really important and productive route to go along. I would really love to be able to talk to people who are doing other things that I may have skills for. I don't really know yet what those other kinds of careers are that, and so I'm unable to conceive of other options for my own career path. And I want to caution us against creating a system that produces graduates who may be seen by potential employers as a jack of all trades but a master of none, because I don't think that's what we are, and I don't think we want to be seen that way. And that's really all I have to say for the moment.
Thanks very much. Our last graduate student panelist is Laura Cameron, who's been a past president of EGSA and is now finishing a dissertation in Canadian literature.
Yes, thanks, Peter, and thanks very much for inviting me. A lot of what Ariel and Josie have already said resonates with me. I particularly liked Ariel's point about being attentive to who is participating in these discussions and not preaching to the choir. And also, as you'll hear in my remarks, the need to banish the failure and the despair, because that's not productive. And Josie, I appreciated especially your point about teaching, because I didn't actually sort of write it down in my remarks, but that was one of the things that I thought and that I was interested to note was not emphasized in the white paper's model. It was sort of there, but it seems to me that teaching, graduate students find teaching very valuable, really put a lot of time and focus and attention into it, and get a lot out of it as well, so ways in which we can emphasize that or make it part of training education, I think it's a good idea. So I've written these things down. I want to say they sound more kind of definite than I need them to sound when I read them out in sentences. So I'm not firm on any of these points. They're just thoughts. I'm going to start with a question that the white paper provoked for me, and then just give some of my perspective. So the question is one that I hadn't really thought to ask before, but I think that it might frame our discussion and future discussions of this topic about graduate education in the humanities. And it relates to the future of PhD that might need to have specific currency, if we want to use that term, outside of academia. And the question is, how is a PhD in the humanities different from a BA? How is a PhD in the humanities different from an undergraduate degree in the humanities? I think some obvious answers probably leap to mind. But I think the question is worth considering deeply. How is a conversation about the value of a PhD in the humanities different from the conversation about the value of the humanities in general, which of course is a very important conversation? And if they're not different, that's fine, but we need to be aware of that. And that has serious implications for what the PhD is, I think. So the white paper proposes on page 3, if you are looking at it, that humanities PhDs have, quote, a respect for fact, a sense of history, the capacity for deep inquiry, critical reading skills, independent judgment, the ability to formulate new understandings of complex bodies of information, and the know-how to put pressure on the established thinking of the present-day academy. Totally agree. I think that's great. But I also think that we could swap humanities PhDs from that sentence and replace it with humanities undergraduates. Isn't that the way that undergraduate programs are and humanities are sold? Again, if we finally decide that they are the same, that's fine, but I wonder about the implications of that. In the academic world, the academic job market, obviously a PhD is very different, because the PhD is set apart largely by specialized knowledge. So my currency in the academic world would be that I know more about a couple of Canadian poets than other people do, and therefore a university might theoretically want to hire me for that reason. An editing firm or a high school or an arts organization or the other places that I could imagine myself working probably don't care quite as much about that. They might want to hire me for my superior critical thinking skills or my top-notch powers of communication. But essentially, then, they're just hiring a superlative, and possibly, from their point of view, a more expensive and less ideologically malleable. or are they, right? the matter is up for discussion. So the white paper provokes these questions for me, particularly in its recommendation of a dissertationless PhD program, but also in what Josie was talking about, the project that it's proposing is essentially things that I think we might already be doing. Mm-hmm. They certainly sound appealing to me, but they take away the one thing that makes the PhD graduate different and leave us with kind of superlatives of what we could get, for instance, that Josie did get maybe in your undergraduate years. I think it's pretty obvious that someone with a humanities education can be a good citizen. Is someone with a PhD just a better citizen? The same citizen, or does it matter? Is being superlative enough? And if we ask these questions in a pragmatic economic sphere, which I know we're trying to get away from, but I wonder if the market outside of, or the market everywhere is competitive, don't you want to be selling things that no one else has? Should PhD students want that? It's a question, I don't know. I'd like to say for the record that I am more or less counting on the fact that superlatives, along with my dissertation and the experience of having written it, will be enough. Admittedly, I'm not quite yet at the stage where I've truly had to confront, in more than a theoretical way, the realities of the job market. But I can't help from believing that a healthy dose of optimism is a good thing. The white paper notes that it, quote, degrades the academic institution of the humanities that gifted younger scholars devote a large part of their lives preparing for tenure-track positions that do not exist. And the notion that younger scholars are preparing for anything specific disturbs me, which is it sounds different, but it's another way of saying what Ariel was mentioning about diversifying education. I don't really feel like I am preparing for something specific. I think I'm preparing skills that will use me, that will serve me in a lot of different contexts. And I think we should feel comfortable and confident pursuing work outside of the academy. So things that we can change in order to make other PhD students feel this way is important. I also wonder about the word training and whether that's the right word. I clearly it was a carefully thought out word, but I'm just interested in it. I would like to note that the thing that I like least about the whole experience of being a PhD student right now is the constant barrage of depressing statistics coming at us. And I say this not because I want to hide from the news and be ignorant, and I understand it's important to be aware of reality, but I think that the rhetoric of despair is overblown. I know things are bad, but I'm here, and students like me will always be here anyway, so how do we proceed? And I actually think that all of the talk about jobs and the general failure to get jobs just makes people ashamed that they've chosen to embark on such a practically fruitless endeavor. And I think that a PhD is hard enough without any additional guilt. But I'm interested in the source of any guilt that people feel, or shame, and I think some shame might come from the awareness of luxury, from the feeling that PhDs are elite things to do, and that you kind of are uncomfortable with that, with the possibility of that fact. Mm-hmm. So for instance, I recognize I'm quite content. I'm happy with my life right now, but I recognize that that has to do with the comfort of my position. I'm in my 20s, not my 30s. My only dependents are my cats. I have no debt. I have a supportive family. I like my dissertation and my supervisor. I like the program here. So I get it. I'm one of those entitled students. I basically just assumed that I would do a PhD ever since I learned what one was. And if there was an end game for me, it was not to get an academic job, but to follow school through to till the very end because I like school. And I think there are other people out there like me. There must be. I recognize the privilege of that point of view, and I'm a little bit uncomfortable with it, and I'm interested in interrogating that discomfort. But all of my contentedness aside, I know very well that to suggest that nothing needs to change would be wrong. So I agree with Josie that finding new ways of conveying and contextualizing our ideas as humanists is crucial. I think the era of the solitary humanist is waning, the white paper says, although I wonder if humanists were ever truly solitary. I think it is waning in part because the era of information and communication technologies is waxing, and I do think that this is a good thing. PhDs are important because even if the solitary humanist joins Twitter, the era of rigorous disciplined learning should never wane, and the PhD is a reminder of that. My musings haven't really offered any answers, I'm afraid, and they might hopefully have raised a few additional questions. I think that marrying the rigor of the dissertation with a few new forms of social engagement, new ways of getting the ideas out there, is an important way forward. Although I fear my own entitlement, I also think that adjusting our attitudes about the functionality of PhDs and getting rid of the failure is a good thing. And I think that if we want to be at least somewhat functional in our discussions, then thinking about what makes PhDs unique might help to advance the discussion. So, stop there.
I will be speaking now for Katie Zion. She gave me her notes. She's off doing the very old-fashioned kind of dissemination of her research at a conference. Her remarks come directly out of one of your central points, Laura, of how is a PhD different from a BA? And I think that she sort of starts from there. So this is Katie Zion. Within the debates over the future of the humanities lie many distinct but interlinked issues. These include how to attract prospective undergraduates to the humanities, the goals and realities of humanities graduate study, and the humanities' place in higher education's changing institutional context. I will not claim the authority to comment on all of these topics, but will rather focus specifically on graduate training. I take cues from recent articles in the Chronicle of Higher Education, including the excellent Welcome to Graduate School, September 2014, Graduate School is a Means to a Job, March 2012, and observations by academic career coach Karen Kelski on her blog, The Professor Is In. I also reflect on the many things that my graduate program did right in shaping my orientation toward the profession and to my time in grad school. Graduate school sharply breaks with the styles and goals of knowledge absorption and production engaged in the undergraduate years. Graduate students are learning a trade and specializing in an area of research, acquiring many skill sets and concepts not imparted in bachelor programs. Secondary sources and theorization are often foregrounded over close readings of primary texts. Choosing a thesis topic is newly freighted. Other students can be both friends and competitors, and job market uncertainty reigns. Grad students are, therefore, justifiably often insecure and demoralized, buffeted emotionally by forces beyond their control. They often experience the famed imposter syndrome, doubt about their command of the field, which is itself beautiful, unwieldy, and riven with internal fissures. So what is in graduate students' and faculty mentors' control? Let's turn to the debates over graduate school's labor of love. Some students manage to get through grad school out of pure love, but love is liable to fade under duress. This is Katie speaking. Students may be unsettled by new, discomforting ways of approaching the object of study that formerly brought them such joy. For example, grad students may engage less with primary texts and more with different applications of theory, which may remove some of the text's pleasure. Yet if a student goes through an entire stint in grad school without any fundamental challenges to his or her worldview, including his or her love for a topic, then she or he is not being challenged sufficiently. I would argue, and does not have truly committed interlocutors. Challenges produce doubts which often subvert love and the confidence that goes with it, yet challenges and changes are necessary for improvement. In contemplating the goals of a good graduate program, then, I would like momentarily to put aside these debates about love versus labor. Rather, I would stress professionalization, which intervenes in this binary. Professionalization does not, in fact, remove love from work. It supplements love and investment with expertise and self-awareness, producing a more responsible and critical form of love. Professionalization in humanities academic study can mean a variety of things, developing new areas of research, doing revisionist histories and critical readings against the grain, leading discussions and forums, and holding oneself to a high standard. Professionalization means that the end's goals should be visible in the processes and mystification should be avoided. While we need passionate grad students, we also need students who are not blind to the dire job market that awaits them. I believe that it is our responsibility to inform graduate students upfront of the challenges they will face in graduate school and beyond. A good graduate school program should be honest with its inductees, but also help them to plan for uncertainty by equipping them with resources to improve their chances and prepare for many work environments. Professionalization and the acquisition of multifaceted skill sets will allow grad students to transform into scholars, teachers, and researchers with a sense of themselves fitting into a broader career landscape. From the beginning of my time in grad school, my program imparted these skills. We had frequent professional development workshops on best practices in conference going, publishing, applying for jobs, and the like. We wrote up these meetings minutes on our blog of best practices. Teaching was a central part of our program. We all designed and instructed several courses and shared syllabi. Importantly, people skills were included in our program. We had many events, mixing faculty and students with opportunities to engage, network, and mingle in semi-professional settings. We were fortunate to organize biennial symposia, inviting prominent scholars to share their work. These events exposed us to ways of being in the field, albeit in a semi-protected environment. We also learned basic etiquette. Professor Tracy Davis invested time in guiding our ambitious, considerate, and supportive cohort, whose networks remain long after grad school. Additionally, the faculty of both theater and performance studies programs at Northwestern were instrumental in helping us with all aspects of our professionalization. These techniques are echoed by the article, Graduate School is a Means to a Job, which advises students to seize control of their graduate education from the outset, as no one will hold their hands and guide them through the process. They should write papers that will be potentially publishable and attend all visiting speakers' presentations in the department. Above all, the author advises, make your mistakes in graduate school where the stakes are low and where you will probably get some useful, if unnerving, feedback. This is tremendously important. While having recourse to a program that both supports and critically challenges them, graduate students need to be proactive themselves in several ways. They need first and foremost to develop support systems, whether among peers or with professionally trained counselors. Northwestern is unique in offering affordable health insurance that greatly subsidizes mental health for students, including grad students, and this helped me greatly in defining my goals and working through the stresses and subpar funding and an uncertain future. Professionalization also means that grad students must rip off the band-aid. This is Katie's last point. For some, but I'm not sure what that rip off the band-aid might not mean so much to you, but here is what it means to her. For some, this means recalibrating their understanding of a field, realizing they must change their topic, leave their methodological comfort zone. Graduate students will need to become alert to the standards and benchmarks of excellence in their field. For others, this means changing the ways that they budget time, since the undergraduate all-nighter will not work in graduate school, and time management and planning techniques will become increasingly central to success. Projecting may seem painful in light of an unknown future, but exercises in planning are, in fact, very useful for structuring time and managing large-scale projects. For still other students, ripping off the band-aid will mean admitting that graduate school simply isn't for them, and that dropping out is not a sign of failure or lack of intelligence, but of self-knowledge. Students must learn to be honest with themselves, and faculty should not be complicit in delaying or obstructing such recognitions. Graduate students will need to, quote, take their egos out of the process, as Kelsey advises. This means being vulnerable, submitting to the critiques of their peers and advisors. The onus is on the individual student within her or his support network and with the counsel of diligent, caring faculty members to learn to treat grad school as a stage in a longer process of professional development, not as an escape, pure exploratory fun, or an extension of undergraduate years. On completion of grad school, I possessed numerous skill sets, but I also learned not to be narrowly invested in an academic career. I was actively and happily considering other options and skills in many areas, including arts management, editorial work and journalism, theater production, grant writing, and tutoring. Perhaps this is due to the interdisciplinary nature of theater and performance studies, but graduates from Northwestern University's conjoint programs go on to pursue a variety of careers, many outside of academia. These include managing a large theater company in Washington, D.C., and a professional African dance troupe, running the Center for African American Studies at the University of Illinois, Chicago, planning events for the dance department at Columbia College and the University of Michigan, leading AIDS activism in Chicago, running for office in Iowa. Arguably, the skills developed in graduate school, writing, reading, research, analysis, networking, and the drive to look beyond surface narratives to attain greater insights and make lasting contributions, have aided these former graduate students in seeking out such multifaceted careers. And isn't this an ideal outcome of graduate school? The infusion of talent and investment into many areas of society and not just the secluded ivory tower. We must valorize the many career outcomes that a graduate degree in the humanities can enable and encourage students to exercise creativity in thinking about their future places in society while giving them the best support that we can to excel in a complex environment.
So, and now our next speaker will speak in her own voice. Maggie Kilgore, who has been a past chairman of the English department and a past director of the graduate program.
And general dog's body.
And was the main spark for the humanities discussions last week.
Yes, and as a result, I talked a lot about that last this subject last year, and many of you were at the discussion, and I learned a lot from it. And I wanted to do something a little bit different today. A graph is going around. If I had benefited from the kind of training that Paul is imagining for the future, I would have been able to show this to you, probably in 3D or Technicolor or something, but instead we've got, you know, sort of old-fashioned handouts here, which I hope that you can look at. What I was thinking was, like, a couple of weeks ago I was talking to the MA bibliography on a related subject, and I asked the students there what advice they'd been given by their undergraduate universities when they had been thinking about going to graduate schools, or indeed, you know, whether they had been encouraged to go to graduate schools. Had the universities had any kind of sessions on the issue? And one of the things that shocked me is, in fact, many of the universities didn't have anything. The students were left on their own. But there were some that were organized. And I was particularly interested in one of the students spoke about a session that she went to at U of T, which was organized for all the students who were interested in going to grad school, and which basically offered one piece of advice: don't. There are no jobs. Do not go to graduate school. Now, one of the reasons that I was really interested in this was that I had attended that session at U of T 30 years ago. I was getting exactly the same advice, because in the 1980s, it was also a time of no jobs. The white paper begins by referring to the chronic problem of humanities PhD academic underemployment. It's certainly been a chronic problem, you know, sort of throughout most of my career. So I guess one of the things that I really wanted to talk about was getting us to think about why we're talking about it now, why it's a particularly hot topic. Is there something that's different about the crisis in the humanities today from the crisis of the humanities that's been continuing since the 1970s? That there certainly is the perception, and the white paper refers to this, that the number of available tenure-track positions is declining, not increasing. But I wanted to just think about that a little bit more. Now, the graph that I've given you comes from the MLA report, from the job information list in 2013. And you don't need to really even look at the details to get a sense of the pattern there. It's a kind of manic flux, basically. In which the lowest point came in 1993-94. I'm looking at the English edition, not the French, the foreign language edition, which there were 1075 jobs. And then the next lowest was 2009-10, which had 1100. And you can see that kind of in the middle there, between 1992 and 1997, there's quite a 7-year depression, and then there's a big leap upwards. And what I wanted to talk a little bit about were some of the reasons for these fluxes. And I'm not saying that looking at these fluxes is going to allow us to predict the future with a crystal ball, but it can help us see some of the factors that have accounted for this situation, and perhaps give us a context for the discussion of where we are now and what we might want in the future. Now, one of the things you'll notice is this information starts in the 1970s, but the pattern really starts in the 1960s, in the period post-World War II, where with the baby boom, there's an expansion of the universities, which involved also particularly a growth of humanities programs, because these were seen as really necessary to the reconstitution of civilized life after the experience of World War II. So humanities programs were expanded, though in fact all faculties were expanded, again because of the baby boom and the general boom in employment across the board. Now what this obviously meant was that these universities had massive hirings in the 1960s, and we arrived at McGill hearing stories from colleagues who told us about how they'd been hired at McGill before completing their PhD and with no interview. They'd simply written from some obscure university in the US to the chair at U of T saying, "Do you have a job?" And the letter that they got back was a job offer. It's hard to imagine. It's hard to imagine because of what happened then. And this is the irony of the situation. In the 1960s, there were massive hirings. And eventually, by the end of the 60s, most of these people were tenured. What that meant, of course, that all the positions were filled. So that there was nothing right after in the 1970s. It was a situation of a very short, very bloated feast, followed by a long famine. This was still the situation when I was an undergraduate, because the people who'd been hired in the 1960s were still pretty young, and there were no jobs in the 1980s. And very little happened until that generation started to move out. You can see that there's a kind of blip, 1988 to 99. I'm not sure what that was about, because certainly those didn't seem like good hiring years. But for the most part, you know, sort of the trend is low. And then you can see it begins to improve in the 1990s. Now, at McGill, that was still a tough time financially. There were a lot of cuts. And one of the ways in which the university made cuts as today is that people were offered good early retirement deals. And within about 2 years, because of people leaving and retirements, the department shrank from over 40 to under 30. And it's grown up a little bit since then, but it's never going to reach the what it had as a result of the 60s. And you know, sort of with all these people leaving, job positions opened up. But at first there were no replacements because there simply was no money. It was only by the end of the 90s, as more and more people retired and as the economy improved, or so we thought, that positions seemed to open up. So in the early 2000s, as the 60s generation cleared out, a huge new group was again hired, and you can see that between 2000 and 2008, it seems interesting because it sort of 7-year cycles basically, there was again a massive boom in hiring. Now the problem with this, of course, is this means that in many ways the situation of the 60s was replicated. You have again sort of a lot of hiring, and then immediately after that there's not going to be as much because positions are filled. There are a lot of jobs available and then few jobs are available. So part of the problem that we're facing now has to do with the larger hiring patterns that were generated by the baby boom. Of course, it's always useful to blame for everything in the universe, that set up this kind of vicious cycle. And the sensible thing you would think would be for universities to try to stagger hiring, but that just can't be done because of the way in which funding works. So the current situation is a product then of long-term hiring trends from World War II on, combined, of course, with an economic crisis that also coincidentally began in 2008, you know, sort of really quite a double whammy that, you know, has caused a lot of problems. And the current economic situation is aggravating the situation further in another way because, as we know, it's typical in times of limited resources to cut perceived luxuries, as humanities are often perceived, and this is the point that I'm going to come back to later on. Now, I should say, however, partly looking at this graph, is that I'm not sure that the future of academic jobs is as bleak as it is sometimes portrayed. So, Laura, do not despair. I think there are, you know, still, we like to kind of bemoan things and say everything's getting worse, the civilization is crumbling. But you can see that the trends are much less a kind of down as much more up and down. And, you know, who knows what the, you know, sort of the next years are going to be like. But I just know, for example, that for one of my students, I've written about 20 job letters so far for this year. And compared to when I was on the job market, and I think I applied for about 6 jobs. Though in those days there weren't computers, so it was hard to apply for jobs. But I mean, still, I mean, I think there's, you know, I'm not sure what the, you know, what the future of the market is going to be like. I mean, the problem is, of course, there's a shortage of all kinds of jobs these days. Other kinds of jobs are simply disappearing altogether as we, you know, keep on talking about how jobs are becoming completely outmoded. So while I'm not trying to, you know, sort of lure you here under false pretenses, I don't think we really do know what the long-term pattern is going to be. And I think we should be wary of doing anything that will precipitate our own demise when it's not inevitable. And I think that some of these are coming up in conversation about things that we need to be doing, things to, you know, strengthen our position for the future. Now this obviously, we still need to think about changes. Though this itself is also not, you know, something new, I should say that I can't remember exactly when it was, but there was a period probably about 10 or 15 years ago when the department went through a major sort of restructuring of the program, trying to address exactly some of these problems of encouraging students to get through the program more quickly by streamlining requirements to be sort of moving them in the direction of their thesis and, you know, sort of other things like that. We need to obviously build on that. And I'm really interested, and I think it's especially important to hear from the students within the program as it is now, to see what other things can be done. So we need to think about changes. I mean, let's face it, the economic situation does not look like it's going to resolve itself fast, at least here. And the fact is, and has been since the 1970s, and I would love to actually get information from before that period too, that many graduate students from doctoral programs don't get jobs in their fields. As we've been talking about, however, this doesn't mean that they don't get jobs. Both the MLA and the AHA, the American Historical Association, have noted that we really need a lot more hard data on what happens to PhD students who don't get academic jobs. Some of the evidence is very good, and the white paper talks about that, that, you know, they get jobs that seem to be remunerative, fulfilling, worthwhile, that they earn more, are less likely to suffer unemployment, though I know the caveat with your statistics are that they refer to all PhDs and not just humanities. But in terms of the humanities, I do think we have some very positive evidence and experience from our students, or, you know, sort of in most of our cases, to our friends, you know, people who were in graduate school with us who didn't get jobs and have gone on to very interesting careers. We also have to remember that some of those choices do depend on circumstance. One of the problems with McGill, being a McGill student, is the Montreal factor. There are very many students who come to McGill to do a PhD and just decide that ultimately being in Montreal is more important than getting a career somewhere else. And some of those people end up in Cégeps. A lot of our students have ended up in Cégeps. And that's been it's been wonderful for us too to have them teaching, you know, the undergraduate students, training the undergraduate students for us. So I think we need to know more about that. And I do think, you know, to pick up on something that's come up a number of times, that we really do have to counter, and I'm always disturbed to hear this, that the kind of assumption that the students who don't finish or don't get academic jobs are seen as failures. Because I think, you know, in many cases that's just not true at all. They're very, very successful. But I think it's very true that we need to promote that more. We need to find out more about that. We need to find more ways of making contacts between those people and people in our graduate program. So I do think we need to know more about where people do go before we decide, especially to reform programs with the deliberate intention of making the students more adaptable to non-academic needs, because that itself is also such a broad category. And, you know, like the rest of you too, I think I'm concerned about the recommendation about the abolition of the dissertation. I'm not sure that specialization makes one unfit for thinking outside the academic world. It may possibly also give you precisely the training that is needed or that helps you in many, many other fields. It probably depends on the job. That, you know, getting rid of a dissertation might simply have the effect of making graduate students unfit for academic jobs, where the assumption is that a scholar will make a contribution in their field through a thesis, which is easily then turned into a book so you can get tenure quite soon afterwards. So it will disqualify students who want to be academics without necessarily qualifying students who don't want to be academics to be anything specific. But anyway, my concern at the moment is not with discussing specific reforms, though, like everyone, of course, I have some suggestions, none of which are particularly unoriginal, however. But what I do want to do is just contextualize our current moment in the history of humanities education, so we can think about, you know, sort of what the issues and what reforms are needed. And what I'm giving is a very small part of a complex situation. The question of the uncertain job market, though, leads me to some differences between the meeting that I attended at U of T and the one that was held, you know, sort of a year or two ago. One small difference, I think, would be that I don't think there were very many students at my meeting. Not many people were stupid enough to think about being an academic. And, you know, I think I was there, and, you know, so maybe a handful of other people, and, you know, I don't know how many others went on. The recent meeting at U of T, I understand, was very, very well attended. And I think that is very interesting, that, you know, sort of there's been a growth of interest in graduate school and a growth of cohorts. And, you know, one thing I would say in terms of McGill's practice is that I've always been very proud that in English at McGill we've always resisted the pressure to expand the graduate program, despite times in which from the province it was extreme. We always felt that we needed to keep, yes, enough graduate students to have a critical mass for intellectual discussions, but not so many students that there would be too much competition for jobs, and we couldn't feel that they had a real chance at a job, that was very important for morale and just, you know, from the ethical perspective. So our cohorts have always been small. Compared to, you know, so many others that have grown. So that's one difference, I think, that, you know, sort of fewer students were thinking about graduate student as something to do. And that's for a specific reason, though, and it was related to something that the prof who gave the session that I went to said that I suspect was not said a year ago. Because what he said was that until recently, he would have told students to do a PhD just for the love of literature and learning, that in itself was a sufficient justification for going on. It didn't matter if there weren't any jobs, do it for the love of it all, for self-fulfillment. This is obviously someone who came out of the 60s, you can just tell. But he said that he felt that he couldn't do that anymore, that wasn't enough, that people weren't going to spend 10 years of their life just for that. Now, obviously, okay, that sounds like really good advice, and that's the way we feel today. But what was interesting is that this was kind of a new discovery for him. Before, he'd felt that it was quite all right to do the degree just for the love of it. The future didn't matter. And I think one of the things that moment sort of captured to me was a kind of shift that also began in the 60s, what has been described as the transformation of something that had been previously imagined, idealized as a vocation, into a profession, with the result, of course, that a generation of tweedy, absent-minded professors were succeeded by, you know, people in business suits, you know, sort of very high-powered. Now, many of us still today think that at the heart what we do is our vocation, that, you know, sort of we love it, that it's very important, that it matters to us. But we'll consider professionals, of course, whose success is measured by productivity and impact, and there's the increased pressure to publish and get grants. And that's a way in which, you know, sort of the structures of the universities have changed and something we need to think about. And in many ways, it seems to me something that's had a lot of bad effects. There are just too many books being written. We really don't need all that many. There is a good side, Milton. People have written about Milton, come on. The good side of this has been that graduate students started getting paid real wages. And that's one of the reasons why the graduate student cohort started increasing. Partly, too, as the white paper mentioned, because of shirt grants as well. Sort of the interesting effect was that being a student actually began to look like an attractive job, better than other things that you might do coming out of a BA. And it's interesting to consider the effect of that. Certainly I've seen some cases in which it actually pays better to be a student than it does to be a beginning teacher, if you get the right grants. So Now, this seems to me a sign of, you know, sort of just larger changes in the university culture that I think, you know, we do need to think about, and changes in the understanding of what a university is. And as I've said before to some of you, it's kind of fascinated me that, you know, about 10 years ago in England, many of the trade schools and polytechnics were made into universities, and there's been almost a kind of inverse shift elsewhere in a drift towards the assumption that universities themselves are going to be trade schools that guarantee that students study something that's going to lead them to a job. And as I've said, also said before, one obviously doesn't study to not get a job. It's hard to imagine any program that would proudly announce, study this and you'll never be employable in any field at all. I mean, that's, you know, kind of dead. But one of the problems, I think, is, and this is related to today with the economy as it is, that forms of education that do not lead directly to jobs are undervalued. They're seen as luxuries that individual and society can't afford. And there have been proposals in Australia and the UK that universities stop funding students who choose them to punish them for doing something so selfish. And this is kind of picking up too on the guilt that Laura was expressing earlier, that, you know, students often do feel that there's something really selfish about studying the humanities, that they should do something altruistic like study business or management. you should be doing something that's going to lead to get you a job one way or another. So I guess what I just wanted to draw was more, you know, really the context of the discussion, that we have a situation of, you know, a kind of manic cycle of job postings. We do have, job availabilities. At the moment, we're experiencing an economic crisis. And there also is the changing idea of the nature of the humanities and the university, the professionalization of the university, what many of us would refer to as the corporatization of the university. And I know that today we're mostly concerned with, like, small, you know, sort of questions, like practical things that we could do. But I do think we do need to think about the larger questions. What is the role of the university today and the place of the humanities in it? That the role of the university has been changing since World War II. That the generation after World War II, too, could take for granted the value of the humanities, because the aftermath of that war made culture, civilization, you know, great books seem really, really important, something that needed reaffirming, that people should be studying in order to put the world back together, that there was a kind of consolidation of those values after the shock of the war and the Holocaust. And we're not in a position to take that for granted anymore. So one of the things that I do feel, and this is why I was running the series last year, is that in many ways what we all need to be is radical, even militant humanists, articulating to ourselves and to the public the value of what we do. And in that respect, the people who do not go into academic programs play an extremely, extremely important role. That, you know, the white paper, I think, very eloquently celebrates what we have to offer, and we all have to be doing that. So I think if I did try to imagine, you know, sort of one possible thing that we might add to the PhD curriculum as it is, maybe it should be something like self-defense for humanists, or, you know, how to defend yourself against, you know, engineering students who claim moral superiority over you. That I think, you know, we all do have the future of the humanities is really going to be evolving, you know, sort of making a case for our values. And, you know, I was struck also, you know, by when Josie was talking about, you know, sort of resisting, embracing the logic of the market. I think that's a very important part of what we have to do.
So I'm sorry that the panel's remarks are going on.
But yes.
Just one more, but luckily they're very different. And this one, this is from Andrew Bricker, who's also getting a conference paper at the moment, and so he couldn't be here. But he's now a Mellon postdoctoral fellow in our department from Stanford University, and so he brings an American perspective from
that situation within American doctoral studies, that means that he, some of the things don't really apply to McGill's situation, but it really is interesting to see what he thinks from a continental perspective. He has 2 points with two modest proposals that are, you know, meant to sort of be thought-provoking or provocative or whatever. But anyway, so I'll start. This is Andrew Bricker this time. First, I want to applaud the authors of the white paper. I think they have made a laudable effort to redress some of the current failures of the doctoral model to offer concrete recommendations, especially around what dissertations might look like in the 21st century. I'd also like to thank Peter for being my avatar. Please direct all angry comments and all food projectiles at him. And then he goes into his modest proposals. As a recent doctoral candidate and a current postdoctoral fellow, I want to speak to two aspects of the conversation today. The first is time to degree. The second is broader and probably much more controversial, the economic collusion that seemingly typifies graduate education in the currently anemic academic job market. First, time to degree. Why is it that after only 3 years of advanced study, attorneys can defend murderers and medical residents can take part in surgeries, but literary scholars require 5 to 9 years of training to explain a sonnet? Very simply, time to degree needs to be and should be reduced. But how? Here is my modest solution. If we take for granted that the centerpiece of a PhD is and should be the dissertation, even if we redefine what a dissertation would be, then we need drastically to shrink the amount and total length of coursework done by graduate students. How, though, to do this without jeopardizing one of our favorite fictions and pieties of graduate education, breadth? The answer is, I think, to have doctoral candidates take a greater number of courses in a single full academic year. And then I'll stop there because it's so, in some ways what he's proposing is sort of what we do. but he's suggesting that in one full year, including the summer, doctoral students would take all of the courses that we would take as MA students and as PhD students in Canada, and not do papers in all of them, just do papers in some of them, but just get that over with. And then I'll go back to his... He has the logistics worked out of how that would work. Thus, 1 year of coursework, perhaps 1 year of exams and dissertation prospectus writing, that would be our CRP year, and 2 or 3 years of writing the dissertation, whatever form the project takes. It's not 3 years, to be doctors and lawyers, but it is a better than feasible 4 to 5 years, especially if we take seriously alternative models for the dissertation. So that's the first one, just, you know, somehow reduce the coursework or spread it out or whatever. Now I will play the heel. My second point, let's replace one form of economic collusion with another. The larger problem with a PhD has nothing, absolutely nothing to do with the structure of graduate study and the training of grad students. The larger problem is the simple fact that universities knowingly produce qualified PhDs in gross and even unethical excess of the total number of tenure-track positions created. It's that simple, too many PhDs, too few jobs. This larger problem is tied to the perverse economic fact that the primary commodity produced by every department within every university at the graduate level is the labor force it eventually hires, underemployed, or casually discards. It is an utter conflict of interest that universities can mint as many PhD holders as they wish with few, if any, repercussions beyond an absolutely bloated pool of qualified candidates for the limited numbers of positions it eventually creates. The incentives to admitting and graduating an inflated number of PhDs for such institutions are clear. Graduate students are cheap labor. Unhired PhDs that work as adjuncts and long-term lecturers are cheaper labor than eventually fully tenured faculty. And an artificially bloated pool of qualified candidates allows universities to hire in an extremely selective manner at less competitive salaries and with fewer benefits. So I'll skip that part, but he said this is by no means McGill's fault, but I don't think we really do that so much here, or even the fault of higher education in Canada. But I will actively disagree with the authors of the white paper who refuse on the first page of their report even to suggest that PhD admissions should be reduced.
I find it hard to believe that this is anything other than a problem created by an academic culture and economy as a whole that has been cavalierly, even callously, producing too many PhDs with few consequences beyond a tremendous amount of sheepish hand-wringing. Mm-hmm. The simple fact that remains that the easiest way to ensure that the current pool of PhD students and recently minted PhDs in the humanities is given jobs is to, modest proposal number two, stop admitting PhD candidates, perhaps for the next 3 to 5 years. By focusing on admissions rather than what to do with all these bodies once they finish, we can also redress the literally preposterous solutions we seem so eager to propose. We need to stop creating shoulder-shrugging back-end solutions for this very simple front-end problem. Simply put, we are perversely trying to compensate for our unwillingness to limit the number of PhDs granted by suggesting that those new doctorate holders simply get a job for which they are not trained or for which their PhD-specific skills are of little direct value. Though one might argue, like the authors of the white paper, that the world would be a better place if more people had PhDs in the humanities, unfortunately, the non-academic world job market hardly seems to agree or care. I'm not sure that. The back end of the problem, there are too many PhDs, could be corrected in less than a decade by ceasing to admit new PhD students and drastically reducing the number of PhDs granted in total. And if there's more to that proposal too, that would involve that after a period that every university would somehow be allowed to admit a PhD student for every student that they placed. Mm-hmm. And that's how they would reset the balance. Anyway, so it's the, yeah.
Just two things. There's so much to say. Two things. One is that the white paper is not against the dissertation. It's asking people to rethink the requirements for the PhD. And the underlying guiding text is the parable of the talents. That is to say that each of us is given certain gifts and trained in certain ways, and we have a certain amount of time to contribute to the world with these talents and to take seriously this requirement. And in order to do that, what we're imagining in the white paper is the reorientation of the humanities toward the world, not to banish the humanities from the academy, and certainly not to pander to the market, but to move into the political and social world as well. The other thing that I want to say is that the more I think about it, and I was listening to you guys, is that PhD students are brimful of skills. They do not need skills training. What they need is dispositional re-education. Because one of the things that we acquire in the university is an academic disposition. We're disposed to do our work in the academy. If we go into another environment, it feels like an alien place and we do not feel like ourselves. But if we had a greater mobility, a kind of psychic mobility, to move into other environments, a kind of dispositional mobility, then we could take the skills that we have elsewhere and the kinds of understanding. I was just listening to this, and this is the kinds of critical, articulate analysis that is valuable anywhere.
Of course, but I think there's also a value to be said for actually having something that defines those things, like, for example, having, you know, specific pedagogical training is something that a lot of us
yes.
would like to have, or, you know, it's the kind of things that we talk about all the time in more nebulous ways, but why not lay that out in a more defined way, I guess, and have students thinking about it in more specific ways.
See, when you talked about teaching, it was teaching within a classroom of one kind or another, but teaching goes on in the professional world in so many different contexts.
Brian? I just want to repeat the earlier remarks, but thanks for a white paper which, for 90% of its length, I think is extremely valuable. There's a lot of work put into that, and it's very useful to have that information. We have not heard a single speaker today support recommendation 2, that the dissertation be abolished. And I think it's important to underscore that, and I second that resistance, or I ninth it, or whatever. And I think it's very important that the people writing the white paper hear that kind of resistance. But let me suggest a more constructive take on that. I took it when I read the white paper, and I think this is an obfuscation in the white paper, accidental, I'm sure, that when I read recommendation 2 about eliminating the dissertation and replacing it with an ensemble, I think you call it, a project, I took it that you were referring to the 2 speculative new models only. But I then heard by word of mouth that in fact that recommendation means all humanities programs across the country eliminate the dissertation and find new models. And I think that is at the moment obscure. And so my suggestion to those authoring the white paper would be that they limit recommendation 2 to their described new models and suggest that these might be, I'm not for them, I'm not suggesting that. I don't like the models, and I think we've heard many objections. But if the authors of the white paper want to stand by those suggestions, as I think they well might, my suggestion would be that you limit recommendation 2 to new and supplemental ideas of the PhD rather than make recommendation 2 implicitly something that you feel we should all do in all humanities departments in all universities. So I'm just trying to put that more constructively. I think it would help you make the case across the board. Now, I do want to say a couple more things, and I'll try to be really quick. I'm very glad taboo was mentioned at the end, that the major solution needed here is to take in fewer PhDs. I think that's essential, and I think it is a taboo, and it's taboo because every PhD in this room should look around at 2 others and imagine them gone. That's what we're talking about, right? We're talking about 2 out of 3, 3 out of 4 who were admitted not being admitted if we go that route. I just want to make sure that we're realizing that. We're not sort of talking conceptually here. I think that is actually, for me, the only ethical way to respond to the current situation, or at least a major ethical way to respond. The second taboo I'd like to mention, this is not an easy one to find the words for. Not once have we mentioned the definitive role played in a doctoral student's experience by his or her supervisor, and the kind of mentorship that an individual thinks supervision to involve. And I think that any discussion, whether here or a white paper going forward, any position taken by SHRC has to recognize that there are so many individual factors involved in a given doctoral student's success that can't be commanded, alas. We just have no means of regulating the quality of supervision across departments, across universities. And I don't know how to address that, except, I guess, through further vocational training for supervisors. But I think it's something that somehow needs to get into this discussion. Finally, Ned, I think you might want to speak to this, so here's your home run ball. I think we should be talking about the MA, and the PhD is too damn late to be thinking about vocational outcomes. An MA is 1 year of your life, maybe 2. You leave when you're 22 or 23. You're in debt, but you're not crushed by debt. Maybe the MA is the point at which we need to help people think vocationally in ways that move them away from academia. Did I say last point? Oops. One more point. I think we need to know what we want the PhD, what professions we want the PhD to be essential for. A PhD is never going to be essential for a job at Telephone Canada or Stratford or the Walrus. But if we can't say to society, here is the thing that makes a PhD essential, this job, or if we muddy that, I think we weaken the argument for the humanities PhD generally. And that's what I'm concerned about in the current models that are offered here. So I think maybe the intervention should be occurring earlier. It involves taking fewer students, but let's not forget the human cost of that. And it may be that we still need to cleave to the ways in which a PhD shapes people for one particular profession. But we try to do that better, and we try to do that more ethically. Mm-hmm.
There was a response.
I'm Amanda Coburn. I'm a recovering graduate from McGill. I have a PhD, and I don't work in academia. I got a job at a Cetec in Montreal in college. It's just not to say that I haven't applied for work in university. I've always been a strong student, graduated at the top of all my classes. And so I find the statistics provided in the white paper very comforting, because it suggests that my failure is not my own fault. But it's a social issue, and it's an issue that comes from the university. I guess I feel like I'm talking from a place of privilege, because I don't have a job at the university like everybody sitting around this table. I know what it's like to look for a job in the contemporary economic climate. And there's a lot that I really like about the white paper, and I have some problems with it. A lot of them were voiced today. I think that your idea of stopping people from being young idealists who love literature and want to go on to get a PhD at the Emmy level won't work. I was cautioned against doing the same thing, and I thought, surely I will get a job. I've always succeeded. Why would that happen to me? And what I like about the white paper is that it's taking a very realistic look at the job climate. And statistics and graphs are great, but when you're living the truth of spending 7 or 8 years of your life working at something, and then you find a job and you're employed, it might not be the job you want, but yeah, it's a job. Everybody in this room will find a job. The question is, will it be the job you like? What I like about the workshop plan, what I don't like is that it's called a PhD. My problem is largely semantic. I don't think that that's describing somebody who has a doctorate in law. I would call it Master's Plus, or find a connection for it. But what I love about it is that it's got this idea of getting certificates. For example, I've applied for jobs internationally at colleges and American schools, and I can't get one because I don't have a teaching certificate. My brothers and sisters have teaching certificates. I think they earned them with as much effort as I spent last September writing job applications. I'm not sure why education kind of seems overlooked in this proposal. I'd like to see more focus on pedagogical training and pedagogical certificates. Just for the reason of finding work, even internationally. Sometimes people told me we can't hire you because you don't have a certificate in education. If you can show us a certificate, then we can give you this job. And that's just not something I could produce. I could say I have a PhD, that's not enough, and they would say no. So I like the idea of having certificates that you can earn in a year. I think that's really great. As somebody who sits on the executive committee of the English department at Dauphin College, I also am in charge of hiring. And we interviewed several PhD students who are obviously qualified scholars, who can deliver lectures to students who have opted to study English literature at the university level. But at the Cetec level, you are often teaching difficult texts to resistant learners. And that's something that McGill doesn't train me for in the PhD program. And I think that a wonderful opportunity for PhD students in English literature, at least, and in humanities and in philosophy, is to think about how in the future we can teach these texts that are so important to us, these difficult texts, to a new generation of learners. Because they're very different than what we've been used to, and I see a lot in this document that lends to that. And frankly, I wish that some of these options were available to me when I was here. I started working full-time at Dauphin College just as I started my thesis. And the student whose paper you were reading, Peter, she said, go to every lecture. Do everything on campus. It's up to you to make the most of your situation. I find that really unrealistic. I had a full-time job. I was in my 30s. You have to think about your future and security. These are realistic concerns for most human beings, I think, and I was often made to feel, not by anybody present, but by some people in the university system, that working at Asia and not being able to go to conferences because I was actively teaching in the public sphere meant that I was a cop-out or I wasn't taking my academic persona seriously. And what I like about this project is it's changing that conversation, and it's suggesting working outside, ways in which we can work outside the university in a productive way. So I think that it needs some work, but I'm not going to applaud it.
Alex has been trying to...
Yeah, I think I have a profoundly different perspective on this because, A, I'm a classicist, so we're like the useless of the useless. You know, you guys like, you know, study languages people still speak. But the flip side is that I used to work in the corporate world, right? So I have a slightly different perspective on what people expect in the market and what really, you know, the companies and the corporations in the public and the private sector, what they expect from people they're going to hire. The first thing that strikes me, I'm going to just stick to specific points in the interest of debate and keep it short. Number one, what strikes me about this very laudable and interesting project is the composition of the members who are behind this project, right? Professor of French, professor of English, professor of public policy, professor of history, dean of graduate studies, professor of architecture, right? You're noticing a pattern here. This is an odd thing to have people who have seemingly done the impossible and receive tenure track, very essentially cushy academic jobs, for them to be advising on this crisis of employment in humanity. This is akin to having white-collar CEOs give employment advice to people unemployed and shift work. So if we're looking at an advisory body that is very far removed in just in practice and in fact from the very issues that it's trying to address, this is a serious methodological flaw, I think, with this study. Number two is this kind of nebulous question of career development, right? And I agree that we do need to restructure things and that there are issues at hand, but if you look at the core deliverables, right, the soft skills that you want to develop from this reimagined PhD, it's critical speaking, learning, analytical ability, teamwork, right, innovative, project-based learning. This is essentially an MBA. And how is this going to differ from the number of professional programs, right? If you want to redesign the PhD to be a professional development program, how is it going to distinguish itself from all of the other degrees that are out there currently, right? If you want these skills and this outcome, why not just do a commerce degree, right? Why not do a very highly focused MBA in artistic and cultural management, things like this, right? I think that what we need to remember is that PhD stands for Philosophiae Doctor, right? Teacher of philosophy. It doesn't stand for cultural manager. It doesn't stand for middle-level management. It doesn't stand for corporate hierarchy. It is what it is. And we do need to remember that. So I worry that if we do restructure the PhD in this way, what we're going to do is produce a larger cohort, which is already too big, of people that are neither employable in either the academy or in the private sector, right? Because the odd thing with this is you're going to have somebody who doesn't have the traditional requisite skill set and deliverables they need to succeed in the academic environment, and they're also not going to have the real life experience, the professional on the ground education experience of working in the corporate trenches for long enough, right? And the other problem too that this doesn't address at all, and I think a lot of the problem is that this comes from statistics that are based on non-humanities PhDs, is the irony in humanities programs that oftentimes the higher educated you are, the more difficult it is to find a job, right? And the higher educated you are, the more degrees that you have, your employability goes down, especially at entry-level corporate positions, right? Nobody who has a bachelor's in commerce is going to want to hire a PhD in history to work under you. Certainly also not one who's too old, right? So if we do follow these reforms, we're going to produce a bunch of people who are 25, 26, have too many letters after their name, too few deliverable skill sets, too little real experience in their specific domain, and ultimately they're going to be unable to be comfortably placed in a corporate or public hierarchy, right? They're going to be too good at certain things and not good enough at other things, and they'll also be too old. And so I think we need to get the public sector in on this. We need to get these other jobs involved in this kind of deliberative process and see what we do with them.
I won't speak to defend the white paper. The white paper is supposed to be a provocation and it can defend itself. But I will defend the group of scholars who worked with us to produce the white paper. We are talking about reforming the institution from the inside. Very important to have people who understand the institution from the inside and have the ability also to influence the direction of the institution. So I would defend the composition and the very great number of people that we spoke to at all levels within the institution.
Matthew?
Yeah, I could just talk about getting jobs at a college level, at Theta. I had a sort of informational interview with a previous teacher at Dawson, Professor Birdbush, and he said that they'll consider master's students to teach at Dawson, but there's definitely a certain premium on at least being enrolled in a PhD program. And I feel that we should only be thinking about, you know, the university tenure and positions. But we should also be thinking that there might be colleges and stage-ups that are actually expecting a certain level of education, even just for teaching jobs in all the different colleges. I did like to think about it like in terms of a larger field of education.
I had one thing that I came out with. I heard Alex speak last year, one of the humanities things, and I think you brought up these statistics that have been mentioned today. I think that PhD or graduate students in the humanities generally do over a lifetime fare better, mm-hmm. and get better paid jobs in non-academic fields than people who have not had graduate training. So it takes them longer to get going, and there's a period of, you know, self-doubt or whatever.
Or just transition.
And then you have a long list of about 30 or 40 major CEOs who have graduate training.
They weren't all graduate. I mean, that's
the thing, actually. Most of them are undergraduates.
Most of them are undergraduates. Yeah. So they take the statistics. This is the problem, that they have more statistics about the placement of undergraduates and that the graduate students are still unknown. And this is where I do think we really need to know more, because I think part of the problem is it's very hard to predict what people are going to, you know, end up doing. And in terms of like developing skills that are going to lead them somewhere, sometimes the leaps are pretty hard to imagine before. I mean, the stage-out is in many ways the easiest leap to imagine. That's something that happens. Or in Toronto, the community college.
And
that's very common.
I thought that one of the biggest fears or problems with the white paper, the particular possible models for the replacement of the program entirely, which you should read if you haven't read, that would be what Josie mentioned, the fear that this would be a person who would end up being trained to be sort of a jack of all trades,
right.
or whatever, a training or a sort of a very watered down MBA or mm-hmm. something, but you know, would be someone who could not really stand in competition with other people within those non-academic fields and would not be ready for academia. And converse, that's just my biggest fear, really, of the whole thing that you articulated. And then and then conversely, I still have a very conservative sense that really focused, well done professional training in an academic, graduate program that leads to a very specialized, you know, thesis, etc., in the old-fashioned way, actually could, you know, in fact, be a training that could, combined with all this, that would lead could lead to success in the academic job market or success in the non-academic job market.
I mean, I was very lucky in Webdesign because I was a classicist, right? Ironically, that's because you can write well and you can speak well and you can think well, but that was not the goal of my training, right? That was a wonderful side effect of this the traditional humanities education that I had. Something that emerged, you know, had they tried to teach me to be a good web design salesman, I wouldn't have been a good web design salesman because I had these good basic instructions.
Mm-hmm. The truth is, though, you're looking for jobs today. People want to see that you have certificates or experience.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, they won't. You can sell your marketable skills that you gain as a PhD. I have no doubt that I could do 1,000 different jobs just having written a dissertation. It is such wonderful training. I would hate to see that go.
Yeah.
But people who haven't done PhDs don't necessarily know that. So if you're, and I don't mean to sound condescending here, I just do sound condescending. If you're like somebody who's working in human resources and they're, in part responsible for hiring you, if you don't have a certificate in public management, well then, you're not going to get that job at the Banff Center. It sounds totally amazing and appealing. But if McGill does foster some sort of stage or internship or something like that, then it opens up a whole realm of possibilities.
Getting information about what people with their PhDs have gone on to do, and then getting those people to come and talk, and setting up a kind of network so that students can be in contact with them. I mean, sometimes you're going to find this with people doing very idiosyncratic things that aren't going to be particularly, you know, helpful. But I think a lot of the time we'll start seeing patterns and ways in which two PhDs who are out there in other jobs are the ones precisely who are going to be able to appreciate the value that a PhD can offer in other contexts and help support that. So I think that would be very important.
And I think just integrating that in a more meaningful way earlier on in the program would be so, so helpful.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we do it to a certain extent, and, you know, I think everyone tries to help out with that, but I think that's something that, like, it needs to not be an afterthought. It needs to be, you know, it needs to be thoughtfully planned and integrated more systematically, and, you know, like mentorships and either specific opt-in professional training or something similar.
I was talking to this fellow last week. His name is Joe Medchuk, and he's a Hollywood producer, and his latest film was Hitchcock. And he did his PhD years ago in film studies at the U of T, and he did a BA in English here at McGill. Yeah. And I asked him, could you tell me what the relationship is between your graduate education and the fact that you're one of the leading producers in Hollywood now? And he said, frankly, there's no connection. Mm-hmm. The dispositional difference was so strong. I said, so it's just coincidence that you did a PhD in film studies and now you're in film? And he started to think his way into it and just begin to see the ways in which the PhD might in fact have helped him in his career. So it's, you know, it's because we keep these things so separate from each other, it's hard for people, even someone like him, who would seem to have a clear narrative, to begin to see. It's very difficult for him to begin to see the value of the PhD for his career. But I began to sort of get him to see that possibility. But I do agree that we need to bring back people to the academy who've done different things with their PhDs.
Are there other comments that have been pent up?
Oh, you wanted to hit that softball?
Oh, yeah, well, exactly, it's been hanging a long time.
Yeah, so, right, on teacher training, I think this should be expanded, right? And there, you know, the question, it could be go all the way to a kind of joint program with education that leads to accreditation, right? It could go as far as that. But I'm very interested in it at the MA level, but I think it could be a kind of graduate option model on gender women's studies, right? So that you could opt in also as a PhD student. I do think if we rethought the first 2 years, that increasingly are the first 2.5 or 3 years of the program, that we could free up time or something like this that might be more valuable. But on the subject of time, there is a problem here. And so, okay, so within the framework of going on to a very scarce university job, I don't think you can think about time to degree in isolation. It's tied to the tenure clock, right? The question is, I have so much time to get ready to get tenure. And when I graduate within that time, doesn't matter, right? It's I have to reach a certain level of achievement to get tenure, right? In my case, that took a long time, right? And I think it does for most people, right? So you can spend that time in graduate school, you can spend it on the job, you can spend it in a postdoc, right? But for most people, that takes a long time. Now, so we could say that we could tenure people more easily, right? But until we say that, I don't think changing time to degree means much in an academic context. If you're going on to other things, it's still a double-edged. So on the one hand, yeah, it's good to get on with it, right? But I think people will sometimes actually prolong their student status as a shelter from the job market, right? So yeah, I don't think we should make a fetish out of time to degree, right? I think it's really case by case, and it's you know, sometimes longer is better. Mm-hmm. Last thing I want to say, this is just a quick point, but I want to see this graph next to a second graph, which represents the ratio of new PhDs to jobs.
Yes, the MLA doesn't have that. They have all the information about jobs, but they don't give the information about how many PhDs were coming out. Because that would be interesting to see the fluctuation, because I would assume that there'd be an expansion, that there'd be fewer PhDs earlier on and more later on.
That's going to produce more of a downward.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. And I do think that's what I was getting at the size of cohorts. I think that's the problem is that the job market, I mean, the job market goes up and down, fluctuates, but I think you have had an increase in, I mean, not everywhere, of course, and again, I'm stress, but I think we've done a good job of being fairly responsible in restricting our cohorts. But in the sort of 90s, there was a huge amount of pressure from provinces in Canada to universities basically saying, you know, we'll cut off your funding unless you bring in more students. And so some of the, you know, some of the programs swelled up just way too much, and some of them are still too big. So I think, you know, I think it has, you know, sort of varies from university to university, but it's a real issue.
Yeah, I mean, I've just got a quick point and a quick suggestion. I think that, I mean, we are, as academics, we're phenomenally good at researching things. And I suspect that this white paper could benefit substantially from a little bit more of a hardcore statistical research, right? Maggie, I was fascinated by your presentation. Thank you for that. But I think that if we looked at, I mean, first off, the job market is horrible for everyone right now, certainly not academics. I think if we looked at comparable data, like hard data, from people in either the faculty of commerce or engineering or science, see what their placements within their fields are like. We'll get a better idea if we're exceptional, how far off that statistical norm we lie, and thus perhaps we shouldn't redesign everything before it's falling apart. The other thing we need to think about too are the more practical details. So at the time point is a fantastic one within the academy, right? But I think we need to look at, you know, date of first substantial employment, date of first relevant employment, age at first hire, you know, how this is trending in the more general market, whether an enterprise or a company or a government will hire somebody at age 26 or 27 at an entry-level position, whether this is economically feasible, whether this is realistically feasible in our society, and where this is lining up with the demands of the market. And this is fairly easy to do, I should think, right? We're good at researching and learning things.
Do you have a sense, maybe, of how are these only permanent tenure track positions? Do you know?
I have the full. No, they broke it down. They're sort of, this is part of like a million graphs. So I'm not sure if this is. I think this is all the jobs that were advertised in the, you know, sort of, and most of those would be tenure track, but some would be limited contract. So they have further. If you want, I can give you the web page for the. MLA, I don't seem to bring this that document with me. I would like to also second Ned's, you know, sort of issue about the time of completion. I mean, none of us want to drag the dissertation out, but I think, you know, this has been an issue since McGill reduced drastically its time to completion to 5 years. This was an issue that a lot of people thought about because, well, there's certain fields. I mean, we sort of wondered, you know, how do archaeologists who have to go, or anthropologists who have to go and do like 2 years of research, you know, some obscure place, and then come back and write up the data. How can you do that in 5 years? There's certain, you know, the problem with fetishizing the time to completion, aside from the strategics about the job placement, is that it makes certain kinds of research, which are really valuable and we believe in, you know, eliminates them. And this has a real impact. And we do need to be thinking about, you know, sort of, you know, what, you know, what the effects of this kind of decisions can be. Some kinds of research that are really valuable that we need do take more time.
Yeah, I think we also need to think about funding and time internally as well, and how we're working within the economics of our own systems, right? I mean, for instance, I at McGill, I have a 3-year shirt for a 5-year degree, right?
Yeah.
I mean, guilt-based. Like, how did that one make sense to somebody at the university? Are we going to expect you to be here for 5 or 6 years, and we're going to pay you for free?
Yeah.
And then how this works in the job market, right? So, I mean, that might explain this ridiculous attrition rate that we have within the PhD system, essentially voluntary attrition rate.
Yeah.
And then look at what people are, and I think also we need to look at what the dropouts are doing.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You know, was this post-secondary, post-grad education that they had, was this useful in their chosen field of study, or was this a lost time for them?
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of information going on. What I'm interested in, and what I want to come talk to, is students who go out, finish their undergraduate degree, and then actually work, you know, and they do their little thing outside the academy, but then decide to come back to school. And so they have those kind of outside the academy experiences, which perhaps aren't satisfying enough, so they decide to come back, and are older, in fact, I'm older, so I'm like, ooh, now I'm not employable, and I'm only in my master's, so like, then restricting the PhD, But, and I do believe in the competitive aspect of it. I think that was a really interesting point. But the white paper kind of, I felt, is really marketed to a very specific kind of student, one that's been, like, just consecutively through the program. Mm-hmm. And since they haven't stepped outside the academy, gained some of those teaching skills, for example. I have 3 years of teaching outside of after my BA, and so I have this what, you know, something towards the certificate, not the actual certificate. And so I'm you know, I come back and I want a very specific thing from my master's and my PhD. And I feel like a lot of us have some voice and I appreciate that, but I'm just concerned that it's that very specific student demographic as opposed to people who have purposely come back to the academy with something in mind that isn't really being addressed here.
As a matter of fact, one of the recommendations is that department should rethink their recruitment criteria.
Thank you.
Well, I think we've gone way over
time.
We'll have to think. We really haven't thought where we're going with this, but we want to probably communicate something to iPlay and something to our department. And to, you know, so I'll talk to, if you have suggestions, talk to Ariel and Olivia. The you know, people about this, and we can decide what we'll do with this.
Yes, you plug it.
Okay, we're going to have another town hall discussion that is going to be open to the broader Louisville community, and that's taking place next Friday, so we can say 3:30 to 5.
Yeah.
No, 3, I think it's 3 to 5.
3 to 5.
3 to 5 p.m. in the Thompson Town Hall room, so please come out there and continue the discussion. And
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.